This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We live at a time when, as a society, thanks to the Black Lives Matter movement, we're finally accepting that police violence disproportionately impacts African Americans. But Black folk have known this forever, and Black parents in particular have known it and feared for their children. It is part of the talk that Black parents all over the U.S. have with their children, how to interact with the police if they have the misfortune to be stopped by law enforcement, how not to act, quote, suspicious, how to move without eliciting violent reactions, how not to reach for your wallet. In other words, how to survive a police encounter. It is a horrifying thing to have to live with as parents, knowing that the forces meant to protect and serve your family may well simply kill you for no reason at all. Joining me today is Issa Nefertari Yulin. She is the author of Crystal Mourning, a novel described by the Washington Post as, quote, a call for healing in the African-American community from generations of hurt and neglect. She is the recipient of a Frederick Douglass Creative Arts Center Fellowship for Young African-American Fiction Writers and a Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center Fellowship. Her essay, entitled Black Parenting Matters, Raising Children in a World of Police Terror, was published in the new anthology, Who Do You Serve, Who Do You Protect? Police Violence and Resistance in the United States. I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Issa Nefertari Yulin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a remarkable time for us to be talking about this. But as I mentioned, Black parents have had to have the talk with their children for a very, very long time. Can you begin by telling us how that manifests for you personally? You're a mother. It's something that other Black parents can relate to deeply. But if you can share that with our audience, how does the talk come about in your personal space, your family life?
Sure. Well, I think that it first emerged for me as a daughter, not as a mother. So I remember the comments that would be made by my mother, by my father, and very explicit directions that I would be given, as well as a shift in behavior that I would notice that helped to educate me about my encounters with police. As a child, I would hear adults talking about certain police forces in particular. So I knew that the LAPD was prone to violent assault against civilians way before the Rodney King event was videotaped. I knew that the NYPD was pretty susceptible to bribery. I knew that the Boston police could be really tough. I knew that the New Jersey state troopers were also very tough. I heard these stories, I heard about different encounters, and I also knew that when I was alone, my encounter with the police would be very different than if I was with a father or an uncle or a male relative. As a woman, I had to kind of curb my interactions with the police whenever I was with a male companion. And now that I have a beautiful, bright, talented, amazing son, I have had to begin to have conversations with him. So, for example, we've been talking a lot about the upcoming presidential elections, and we've been having conversations about the primary elections. And my son, very sweetly and innocently, he is 7, asked me, why do people feel like Trump doesn't like brown people? That's his language. And I said, well, some of it has to do. So there were a lot of ways that I could have answered that question, but I chose to go right for it. And I said, well, that's because Donald Trump, one of the reasons why is Donald Trump took out a full page ad in the newspaper, the New York Times, about 5 young men who were accused of attacking a woman in Central Park. And he called for them to be killed, to be executed, but it turns out that they were innocent. And because they were African American children, a lot of people don't trust Trump, and they feel that he is not somebody who would be a strong advocate for brown people. I chose that particular historical fact on purpose because it enabled us to open up a conversation about police.
In your essay in the anthology, Who Do You Serve, Who Do You Protect, you write about how you fear, in addition to police violence, the lies that fuel police terror, the systemic way stories about Black people's encounters with the police are twisted and turned by the voice of the state. And in so many instances, in the deaths of young Black boys and girls that we've seen, but in particular boys who are demonized and criminalized that we've seen in the past couple of years, these children are then sort of completely posthumously criminalized as well. And we are told that they reached for the police, that, you know, Mike Brown was this giant that ran after Darren Wilson. And that's another battle that Black parents have to fight after they've already lost their child. Can you talk about that?
Sure. It's almost like a war of perception or a war of point of view. And I use the term war on purpose because it feels very violent to me. So it's like we're beaten down so low and then blamed for being there. It's bad enough that as a mother, you have to worry, is my child going to choke on his food? Is he crossing the street with a walking man, you know, when the light is green? Will he fall off of his bike? Is his helmet secure? Is his seatbelt or booster seat secure? All of those fears that go into parenting, but as African Americans and other parents of color, we have this additional burden of having to fear the very people that we're supposed to be able to say to our children, go to them if you need help. I have never told my 7-year-old to go to the police if he needs help.
Wow.
I tell him, look for another mother.
Wow.
Look for a woman who has children, because I trust a strange mother will stay by my side, my child's side, and make sure that he's okay. And I don't have that same trust for the police. So God forbid the thing that every parent is afraid of happens, and I were to get separated from my child, he, I hope, wouldn't go to a police officer. And that is because another mother I trust will more likely just see a child in distress and in need, as opposed to a police officer whose perception of my child's brown body may be very different. And this criminalization, this demonization of Black children terrifies me, because it is the attitude that enables the physical assaults and killings that we are witnessing on television all the time.
You also write in your essay the kind of training that you feel you have to give your son. Remember the badge number of the police. Don't say anything. Say that my parents will come for me. So in police custody, you know, if a child survives, if a Black child survives a police encounter and is in police custody, there's still a layer of fear. There's still yet another, like, you know, chance that he or she could come to harm.
Well, look at the Central Park Five that I was talking about earlier. Those were children. They were children. Kids.
And they were accused of raping and killing a white woman. And they were interrogated while they were without their parents. Yeah.
Their parents were not present. They started to answer questions. They were videotaped, giving false statements. And they have now been exonerated. But think of all that time. Think of their lives wasted in prison. It is a nightmare to think of your child. I don't want to think of my child behind bars for one moment, much less during the prime of his life. And if he says one thing, you know, I know that if my son is coming home from school, when he gets old enough to walk home from school, and something is happening that doesn't have anything to do with him, that he's not even aware of, and a police officer says, hey, kids, tell me, which way are you coming from? Where are you coming from? If he says, oh, I'm coming from the street where my school is located, and that's the space between which this incident has occurred that he has nothing to do with, he can then be rounded up and questioned. He can be taken to the precinct for questioning, even answering a simple question like, hey, kid, where are you coming from?
And we know that in
all of that, I'm sorry.
We know that in encounter after encounter that goes bad, police say that they picked up this person who ended up dead because they thought he or she matched the description of a suspect. You know, Mike Brown, a suspect. So many names, one after the other, that this was a child, sometimes often a teenager, who matched the description of somebody who was a suspect, or somebody made a 911 call and said this person was armed, as we saw in the case of Alton Sterling. And so to be walking in black skin in the United States, you're basically a suspect for the police. And most African Americans know this. And then police wonder why people are skeptical. I mean, a police officer watching this interview or listening to this interview might feel highly offended that you would rather trust a strange mother than a cop.
I wouldn't want to offend a police officer, and it would never be my intention to denigrate the entire police force. I will tell you that my family has served this country in every conflict that we have been involved in, every war, since the Civil War. Hmm. I can trace my family back to their participation on the Union side in the Civil War. My family has served this country. My family has paid taxes. My family members have provided job opportunities for others with small businesses. I am a teacher. My mother was a teacher. My grandmother was a school nurse. My godmother was a principal. My aunt is a teacher. My other aunt is a librarian. We are people who give, who do our civic duty, who pay our taxes. When I look at police officers, I see my brothers and sisters. I'm telling you the truth when I say this. I feel that I'm connected to them because we are members of a union. I am a member of a union, a different one, right? But that we are union members. I feel connected to them because they are serving the public in a really important way to protect and serve. I actually believe in that ideal. Unfortunately, I feel that, like all of us, these really good people are trapped in a systemically violent system of control that pressures them to prey upon black and brown people. And that institutionalized racism fuels the prejudice that emerges in these encounters, and that implicit bias is what triggers the finger on the trigger, if you will, that enables the violence to occur. I, in my heart, feel that most police officers are good guys, but that they are as trapped in a system of control as the rest of us are, and that we really need to find solutions together to liberate all of us from the system of control and real police violence.
I saw a post on social media the other day that said being against police violence is not the same as being against police. That would be saying that if you're against parents who abuse their children, that you're against parents.
Right.
So you and I are talking at a time when the issue of police violence has flared up once more in the country, primarily because videos exist of police killings. The police killings and abuse is happening on an ongoing basis in this country. But when we can show the videos, when we can see the videos, that stokes more public outrage. And it's very, very hard, actually, to go through all of this, that the trauma is very real. And I'm wondering if you can share a piece of an article that you wrote in Bitch magazine in response to the violent killings of Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, and others, where you reflect on the latest bout of violence. It's a very powerful essay called If We Must Wear Ourselves Out, Let It Be Because We Build. And I was really moved by it. Could you share an excerpt from it?
Sure, absolutely. We know this police state is born from the slave state. We know the patrollers of today are the patty rollers of yesterday. We know there are good cops. We are related to them. But we also know that, good cop or bad, their job is to enforce the rules of a racist justice system. Their job requires circumscribing the lives of dispossessed people. Their job requires responding to the inevitable social consequences of inadequate healthcare, unequal education, and substandard housing with handcuffs that were once iron chains, then perpetuating the deception that it is our fault we are shackled. We are kicked down and then blamed for being so low. We also know the militarization of the police state is not actually new, is not some post-9/11 phenomenon, because we know it was the military at Wounded Knee. We have been here and we have had this done to us before and before and before. A robot bombing a gunman? Well, yes, of course, because a police helicopter once bombed Osage Avenue in Philadelphia, because the National Guard once bombed the Black Wall Street in Tulsa. I support common sense gun laws, but I know legislation will not stop the hate that raided Stonewall, that massacred Orlando, that tortured Matthew Shepard, that killed Keisha Jenkins and 18 other trans women of color last year in the United States. I see you, my sisters and brothers, in the LGBTQ struggle. I see you and I love you. My family, my American people, all of us, oh say, can you not see that we are bound to this monolith, this monument to hate, that we are pinned by thorns dripping with the blood and sweat and salty wet tears of the victims of white supremacy and white privilege and white racism, that white folk are pinned here too. That none of us, not even the cops themselves, are free from this system, except the system controllers, except the 1%, those who are sneering with their Make America Great Again, hate again, hate again, hate again and again and again, occupation of our bodies, our minds, our very souls. We have to join arms together and make ourselves free. Are you ready for this?
Issa Nefertari Yulin reading an excerpt from her new essay, If We Must Wear Ourselves Out, Let It Be Because We Build. It was just published in Bitch Magazine's online website. And we'll post a link to that full essay on our website later today. She's also the author of an essay about Black parenting in a brand new anthology published by Truthout called Who Do You Serve, Who Do You Protect? Actually published by Haymarket Books, a Truthout collection. Issa, thank you so much for sharing that with us. I want to just ask you one final question, which is the idea of trauma. When my producer and I, you know, we look through the photographs of the grief-stricken parents of Trayvon Martin and of Tamir Rice and Oscar Grant and Mike Brown and Ayanna Jones, it's very hard to see what they're going through, their faces, the hurt that a parent goes through when they lose their child. There's no other hurt like it, I think. And I'm wondering how important it is for us to see that, because there's also a danger of us being inured to Black grief, right? I mean, and also to the videos showing Black people being killed by police violence. On the one hand, we need to see them. On the other hand, we can't become immune from them. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
I think it's important that we bear witness to our experiences, and I am a descendant of people who for 400 years now have been insisting on bearing witness and telling the truth and stating clearly in whispers sometimes, but always stating clearly one to the other, this is what happens to us. This is what happens when the sheriff is around. This is what happens when the deputy comes around. This is how you stay alive. And that legacy of bearing witness to me is the only reason that I can sit here talking to you today. So I am glad that all of us, those descendants, we the descendants of those people, that we continue to bear witness and we use new technology to do so. We have to document the truth because for all these hundreds of years, people have been telling us that we're lying, that this isn't what's happening to us, that Michael Brown must have been lunging at that police officer. And if we had something on tape, then we would be able to see clearly the truth. The videotape does not always mean that the police officers are criminal, are put into due process, who go to through the court system. It does not insist necessarily that they be penalized for what they do. But it documents our reality, it documents our truths, and it begins to build a body of evidence. And without the body of evidence, I don't think we can build allies in this beautiful, multi-hued coalition of Black Lives Matter protesters who are coming out to say, there is a problem here. We have seen it. You can't lie to us about it anymore. And we are going to insist that real change happens.
I want to thank you so much, Issa, for joining us today. We'll post information about your work on our website. Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Issa Nefertari-Yulin is the author of Crystal Mourning, a novel described by the Washington Post as a call for healing in the African-American community from generations of hurt and neglect. She's also the recipient of a Frederick Douglass Creative Arts Center Fellowship for Young African-American Fiction Writers and a Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center Fellowship. Her essay entitled Black Parenting Matters, Raising Children in a World of Police Terror, was published in the new book, Who Do You Serve, Who Do You Protect? Police Violence and Resistance in the United States. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.